when I looked at the ride-sharing industry, it just occurred to me that, you know, there's 7 million vehicles on the road. And this was back in 2015, so a couple of years ago, but there's 7 million plus vehicles on the road. Drivers are hurting for cash because of the price competitiveness between, you know, the ride-share companies and how that affected their income. And because drivers are hurting for cash, they're churning out of the industry at an unprecedented rate. So it seems sort of academic that if you could introduce sort of like a retail channel or some type of value add service that the driver earned money from, you could increase retention for rideshare companies, increase the take home for drivers, and create a really scalable vending opportunity for cargo. I would say though that, you know, our thinking about the business has really matured, over the past 3 years. You know, what we've realized in the past couple is that, you know, we spent 2 billion hours in rideshare vehicles last year. By 2030, we'll be spending 20 billion hours in rideshare vehicles. And there's a massive opportunity, not only for in-car commerce, but for the provision of all types of value-added goods and services, whether that's connectivity or entertainment or media or commerce or infotainment or the ability to use our distributed fleet to run last-mile delivery. So our goal now is really to sort of lock down as much of the in-car real estate as we can in as many vehicles as we can so that as autonomy approaches, you know, hopefully we'll become sort of the go-to provider for those vehicles as well.
Interesting. Yeah, we just did a report with Visa on the commerce opportunities that exist today in not in ride sharing, but in commuters. So commuters who are going back and forth to work every day, we estimated that to be $215 billion annual commerce opportunity that people are actually using their apps to order ahead and pick up coffee or food on the way to or on the way from from the office parking and so forth. I mean, it's a massive number. You don't think about it as much, but you're right. Increasingly, people are spending more time in ride-sharing vehicles, and I often find myself in them either in the morning, evening, or afternoon when I'm hungry. So it would be great to be able to buy food. It certainly fits a need.
You're hungry. You're running out of charge. You're going on a date. You're heading to the airport and you're late for your flight. You don't have your toiletries. You don't have your chargers. I mean, I think some people's first reaction when they look at cargo is like, oh God, like another place I'm going to be bombarded. And then I think when you actually experience it, you realize like, wow, like there's no screen. This is totally opt-in. My driver doesn't harass me because like the boxes makes itself apparent inside the vehicle. It's a really seamless checkout opportunity. Like 3% of the goods are free at any given time. And like, yeah, like this is, it's not a massive efficiency. This isn't going to like change my life, but it's a micro efficiency that might improve your day. So, you know, I totally get it. I think, you know, in business and now in life, you know, I just think we're constantly looking to optimize everything. And like, this is just another iteration of that.
It's contextual commerce in a very different way. I have a number of questions though in terms of the mechanics of how this works. So vending is obviously something you're interested in. There's a science to vending in terms of product replenishment, product selection, and just the physical environment of vending. How was your thinking shaped in terms of adapting that to a vehicle and having the right mix of inventory in an environment that wasn't intrusive for the car?
Yeah. So I'll answer that in a couple of parts. One is in just thinking about like the physical environment. I mean, my co-founder that in, you know, first hire, but you know, co-founder of the business is, he's a hardware guy. So we actually started working on a physical vending machine, that departed from traditional coil loaded mechanics, which don't work in moving vehicles, and designed a machine that's strapped onto the back of the front passenger seat. So that's where we started. And we basically, to get something to fit into the vehicle, and it dispensed these capsules that were filled with products. And to our knowledge, it's actually the only IP, and the only vending machine on the planet that works reliably in a moving vehicle, because coil-loaded machines will jam up. But anyhow, that's where we started, and we just kept stripping away elements. We pulled out the IoT elements. We made it smaller. We took away the screens because everybody has a screen in their pocket. And eventually we just sort of reduced it to, you know, essentially just what it needed to be, which was a slightly beautified and electronic display case that strapped onto the top of the center console. The one sort of space that is universal in almost all vehicles, that would give us access to 95% plus of all vehicles and everything from a Prius to a Suburban. And we just said, like, look, this is the one place that we can pretty much count on there being in a vehicle. Let's try and lock that space down and build something that's a one size fits all, and we can optimize and change sizes and make it configurable later. So from a physical standpoint, that's really where we started. In terms of like the assortment, we started by thinking sort of from the bottom up, like what are the need states that people are in? And the need states are fairly predictable for people that are in ride shares. Because, you know, we're doing 15 million rides a day, but they typically tend to be clustered around rush hour, in the morning, rush hour in the evening, and then late night trips, to dinner. And it's especially booming on the weekends. So we said, okay, what are the need states that people are in? And typically people are hungry, in the morning. They're hungover in the morning. They need a snack. They need a pick me up. You know, for people doing the walk of shame, you've got to get them a little hangover scare.
The walk of shame. I love it.
Well, I guess the ride of shame.
Right? The ride of shame.
It's a little bougier than it used to be. You know, those are fairly predictable need states. It's coffee. It's energy. It's a boost of some kind for people that are commuters. I mean, they're out all day. They're going to run ragged. Do they need, you know, it not only a snack, but maybe they need sort of like a vitamin C boost or some type of like a coffee shot or something. You know, for people that are going out at night, they need their breath freshened. For people that are headed to the airport, they need electronics, they need toiletries. Like, you know, I wouldn't say we've necessarily cracked any code yet. You know, it's really thinking about what do people need when they're on the go. But what we can do and what we are doing is, we're starting to build, you know, we've distributed a couple hundred thousand goods, processed well over 100,000 transactions. You know, we're going to distribute more than 6 million goods this year. We're going to have a massive data pool that shows us exactly where, when, at what velocity, you know, products are being sold or ordered. And we're going to be able to optimize really efficiently based on geography and time of day and location, and all of these other variables, and basically build a heat map of like what sells best, where and when, and be able to optimize that assortment that way.
So let me ask you, based on the data you've assembled so far, what seems to be the most popular item, regardless of time of day or day of week? Is there something that is sort of universally appealing?
So I can tell you what is, but I can't tell you definitively because we haven't gotten the merchandising assortment just right yet. But I can tell you that disproportionately sweet and salty snacks do really, really well. Everybody loves to tell you they're healthy. I believe that most people are. You see it reflected in the companies that are booming right now, the RX bars and you know, Kind bars, you know, and things like that. I mean, they're sort of better for you goods, but reality is that people like to indulge as well.
Yes, we do.
So those have done really well for us. Electronics have done well, but we have not included top-end premium electronics, and I think that's hurt us. We have primarily had sort of lower quality, cheaper, generic electronics, and I think what we're starting to see from consumers is that they're actually not quite as price sensitive. They're not going to spend $200 on Bose earbuds, but they might spend 30 or 40 on Skull Candies rather than the sort of like generic Sony earbuds that you would get at an airport. So, you know, we're still constantly sort of like refining. So I would say it's really been sort of snacks and things like that. And then as we get better, I think we're going to see that premium products perform better, more regionally targeted products perform better. People in New York want different things than people in LA and people in San Francisco. So it's just going to be a constant sort of like big data game to see what works best, where and when.
And do the drivers have the ability to select the assortments that they think will best suit their rides? You know, so for example, do they get to put stuff in their trunk, like a bunch of stuff in their trunk, and then display certain things at certain times of day? How does that process work?
So in terms of supply, we're supplying drivers with sort of set inventory, and then they also do have extra stock that they keep in their trunk. They're not responsible for sort of changing the inventory throughout the day. They're just responsible so that they have, you know, different things at night versus the morning. They're just responsible for sort of restocking the box as it gets low with that reserve inventory. And then we ship them replenishments, on a predictive and very automated basis. For our drivers, like we want them to be drivers. We don't want them to be store managers or shopkeepers. So we really built this entire system to just allow them to drive, and we take care of everything else. It's a business, like within their business. It's basically a business in a box. And we try to take care of everything for them, so they don't have to think about replenishments, merchandising, like any of that stuff. So they don't have the ability right now to request certain products, but we are responsive to drivers and, you know, listen to sort of what they're telling us, like, hey, like, this isn't moving. Like, we can see that too, because we can see real-time transactional data for every single transaction, what's moving, what's not. And we keep a really close eye on, like, different product velocities. But we also do listen. The other thing that's cool is that we actually are integrated. We're one of only a couple of companies to have access to Uber's driver API, which gives us a bunch of intelligence in real time about when drivers are driving, where they're driving, start and end points of their trips, different geolocation data, how we impact driver ratings over time, how we impact earnings. And we track all of that, and we try to pair drivers with assortments that best match their driver behavior. So for instance, if a driver is only driving in the morning and we see that, we'll give them one assortment. If a driver is only driving in the evening, we'll give them another. So we try to keep it contextual.
Got it. And how did you identify the initial group of drivers you launched with? Did you put out a call for volunteers? Did you identify certain areas of the country you wanted to target? How did that process work?
Yeah, there's sort of like there was a high level approach and really sort of a grassroots approach. The high level approach was, you know, we said, look, like, we want to be able to ship to drivers in 2 to 3 days max ground to keep our costs down and to keep their wait time for products down. So we're based in New York. That's where I live. That's where my co-founder lives. So we started here and we said, all right, this is our home market. We're going to do the three major markets that are closest to us so that we can show investors after we had raised our seed round that, look, hey, you know, New York City, Chicago, and Boston all have different sort of regional profiles, different product preference, different amounts of drivers, different sort of urban like infrastructure. New York is super dense, whereas Boston and Chicago are a little more suburban. So we set out to basically prove that cargo works in each of those markets. So that was sort of the initial game plan, is like prove that cargo works in Chicago, Boston, and New York, and then we'll be able to raise capital to go and expand into all of the other cities in the U.S. So that was the game plan. In terms of actually like acquiring drivers, we did a handful of things. We did some grassroots stuff, like going to airport lots and recruiting drivers. We worked through rideshare companies to tee us up with Lyft, you know, provided us with, I think, 25 drivers in Boston. Via provided us with, you know, probably 30 or 35 drivers in New York City. Uber helped us secure a couple of sort of affiliate marketing partnerships. And then we also did a little bit of like digital advertising just to test it on Facebook and on Instagram. And all of that got us our first couple of hundred drivers. And then what really opened the floodgates was, we had raised our seed round November of 2016, but we didn't announce it. And we said, okay, we've only got one shot to announce this. We want PR to really drive driver signups, because drivers are normal people. They have, you know, they're different ages, genders, ethnicities. They're, you know, they're a really diverse cohort. So PR should actually be a fairly good driver of awareness. So we held back on our announcement and didn't announce until we had already been piloted in market for a couple of months. And once we were ready to go, we announced the fundraise. We pushed really hard on PR, structured sort of a year-long campaign that's obviously still in motion. And, you know, the Mashable article that we got, you know, somewhere around like July 4th just opened the floodgates for us. our driver signups went crazy. And, you know, 7 months later, we've got 20,000 plus drivers on the platform.
Wow.
And most of that has been, organic, really. I think 70% of all of our signups have either come from just organic, like finding our website and signing up, or from a driver referring another driver.
You have an interesting go-to-market in that you want to establish yourself as a consumer brand. So you want consumers to download the Cargo app, even though they're in an Uber. Have you thought about being able to eliminate the friction of sign-up by linking to Uber account credentials? Is that something you can do? Is it something you might look to do? And what about the opportunity to just license your technology and app to other platforms like Uber, where it becomes like Uber Eats, sort of an extension of Uber, but sort of affiliated with Uber, and they do the customer acquisition and driver acquisition on your behalf?
Yeah, so both really good questions. I'll make one small correction in that we actually don't, I don't want to do it on the pod because it won't be very interesting for any listeners, but I'll show you a transaction at the end, like how okay. Product selection works for a passenger. You actually don't have to download an app. All you have to do is scan a QR code that's posted on top of the box or enter a very simple URL into your browser on your smartphone. And that'll take you to a page that looks like an image of a cargo box. You enter a four-digit code posted on top of the box, and then you can just make your product selections and check out. You don't have to create an account. You don't have to sign up for anything. You don't have to authenticate with Facebook or LinkedIn. Like, there's really no strings attached, and you can basically check out in 2 to 3 taps. So it is pretty seamless. That said, you're absolutely right. Like, we want to make it even more. And you can, if you want to pay for something, you can use Apple Pay, PayPal, Venmo, all the mobile wallets that are available, we make available to our passengers. But your point is a good one, and it's something that we're really thoughtful about, which is how do we make it even better?
Right.
So in terms of integration, you know, absolutely integrating with the apps of rideshare companies is something that we're really interested in. It's also something that they're interested in. And it's you know, if I had to say, I'm not going to make any commitments on behalf of any of them, but if I had to say, it's a matter of when and not if. In our discussions with them, it's just a matter of cargo being at a level of scale where they are willing to put dev resources behind it. So we, you know, we hope that will happen. And the final thing is around licensing. We should talk in like 6 months, and I will have a lot more to share on that. It's a good idea. Okay. It's a good idea. We're working on something like that, and I will be the first to share it with you. But it's a great idea, and it's something that we're in the process of working on.
Got it. So speaking of scale, you're obviously in demand. There are a lot of Uber drivers. You've penetrated, you know, a significant swath, but there's a lot more to go. Just on Uber, what is your capacity for cranking out cargo boxes and supplies?
So it's a good question because we've had to be really, really disciplined. Like we, you know, 4 or 5 months after our launch, we had thousands and thousands of signups in all of these cities where we weren't operating. And the constant conversation we were having, it's like, should we be shipping boxes out to drivers everywhere, or should we stay disciplined and we should go market by market and actually optimize for market density as opposed to market breadth? And we've tried to stay disciplined and optimize for market density because we have seen in smaller test markets, for instance, in Champaign and Peoria outside of Chicago, where we have a relatively high percentage of drivers in those cities using cargo, our conversion rate on passengers, meaning the percentage of passengers that will place an order, is almost triple what it is overall for our entire fleet. And we believe it's because passengers are seeing cargo multiple times, they're testing transactions, they're getting comfortable with it, they know how to work it, they see that, you know, to your point, you actually don't have to download a mobile app. It's a really easy, seamless experience.
Right.
And that's really incrementally good for our business. It's good for our drivers who earn more money. It's good for our passengers who can begin to rely on this in cars. It's good for cargo because our conversion goes up. We can distribute more products. So we've basically said, look, we know it sucks to have drivers in Seattle and South Dakota and Montana and Idaho and Dallas who don't have cargo boxes right now. But we've got to go market by market. And the only constraint we've really had is that we try to keep a couple of free goods in the box at any given time. And the free goods are things that brands are distributing to us, and we are then distributing to consumers basically as a form of like sampling. So if you go to marathons, people hand you free products. You're walking on the street, people hand you free products. That's all a form of marketing, right? What we allow brands to do is just get their products in front of people and have you try them and fall in love with them. It's like Skittles. Like, I hadn't had Skittles in like 10 years. And when we started working with them, like, I realized, like, holy cow, like, these things are really, really good. So they want to replicate that, that experience with all of their customers in our cars. So for us, you know, one of the, like, we can make boxes all day, right? We're really good at that. We've got more drivers than we need. For us, the big thing is just we're building out an enterprise sales team to go and knock on more brand doors and say, hey, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. We're the only scalable solution for you to reach passengers in rideshare vehicles. Those passengers are young, they're educated, they're mixed gender, they're mixed ethnicity, they're affluent, they're mobile, they're likely to share their experiences on social media. They're like your next generation of customer. They're exactly who you want to get in front of. Like, let us help you do that. So for us, like, scale is just about bringing on more people, working with more brands, and hopefully bringing this to, you know, to all of the major markets and, you know, in the U.S. where we have signups.
Yeah, no, I think your strategy of getting density in markets is a really good one. I think going broad and not very deep, to your point, it will just take you longer to get to where you need to be. You need to have the density and the familiarity so that consumers who do travel from city to city, but that's certainly not everyone, will get the experience in their own hometown and then be delightfully surprised when they see it in other cities near them where they happen to be traveling as you expand. But I think that's a wise way to go. You're also building an ecosystem, which is interesting, of not just drivers and passengers, but of brands who want to get in front of a captive audience. It's almost like standing in line at the grocery store and having all those things staring at you while you're in line, and you grab them and put them into your basket. It's almost that sort of an experience.
It's exactly like that. I mean, it's a great analogy. And sorry, I've got some sirens on our street. I hope it's not bothering. But it's a great analogy. And, like, frankly, you know, I think brands realize that those checkout lines are disappearing. Like, Amazon Go just came out. They're not unique. Those are going away. Like, right. You know, Kroger is already working on the technology to get rid of checkout lines.
Yep.
Walmart just introduced a consumer app that allows you to scan the products that you want, throw them in your cart, and leave without checking out. Like, all of those products are going to need to find new homes. And, like, we can be one of those homes.
Interesting. One final question, and then I'll let you go. Economics that you talk about on your website, that drivers can earn a lot of money every month, $150 a month. That's a nice, you know, that's a nice lift to their paychecks. How does that money get? How do you make money? I know how they make money, but give me an understanding of how you make money.
Yeah, so we're basically generating income in two ways. We're buying products and retailing them like any other retailer would. So we make margin on goods sold. And then we work with brands who are, compensating us for essentially acting as a marketing and distribution platform, for products. So we're basically, you know, earning money in those two ways and then compensating drivers, based on the volume of products that they distribute.
Got it.
And they can earn money through, on a per transaction basis, they get, it's $1 per transaction. They get 25% of retail goods sold. If they move certain volumes of goods during a month, which is not so much a way to get them to be salesy. Like, our drivers aren't salesy, and we know that because their ratings are increasing. It's just a way to keep them engaged and sort of gamify it and make it fun. They can get additional bonuses. And then they can get sort of cash bonuses for referring other drivers to us, which is, you know, we'd much rather pay a driver to refer a driver than pay, you know, Facebook, you know, $500 a month to spend money on digital ads.
Yeah. But does the driver have to pay for the box? Are they leasing the box from you, or are you just providing it as part of the service?
It's totally for free. So we look at drivers essentially one as partners, but two really is our real estate and almost like a landlord. So, you know, we're sort of a brick and mortar retailer combined with an e-commerce retailer, but we don't have a physical retail location except for these cars. So we look at drivers, you know, sort of as retail partners real estate partners in a sense. The only time a driver would ever get charged, so when they sign up, they include their credit card information. The only time they would ever get charged is if they actually steal the box or the products and we never hear from them again. And then we would charge a $100 deposit fee. But that happens very, very infrequently. And if you return the box to us with a prepaid shipping label that we send to the driver, if they do decide to leave cargo, we will never charge your cards. So it's totally risk-free unless you steal our stuff.
What's the most expensive item you've tried to put into a cargo box and realized people wanted to buy a lot of that actually surprised you?
The Sony earbuds did pretty well. And I think we had them in the airport. They retail for like $19.99. I think we had them for like $15.99 maybe. And they did well. I think I've been talking to a bunch of sort of like next gen vending machine CEOs, and everybody's telling me that things like, you know, the premium skull candies and things like that will do really well. So I'm eager to try those. We haven't yet.
Yep. I mean, I have to say that it's always on my ride to the airport where I realize I've forgotten my charger, you know, my headphones. And at that point, you're not really price sensitive as much as you are demand driven. So,
Well, and you know, when you show up at the airport, you're going to get price gouged. So all we have to do is beat the airport.
Exactly.
Which isn't hard to do.
Listen, Jeff, this has been fascinating conversation. I love the business. You really take in vending mobile, and it's an interesting ecosystem that you're building. We look forward to staying in touch, and certainly 6 months from now on some of the developments around licensing. It sounds fascinating. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, thank you for having me, and we'll absolutely keep you posted.
Thank you. Continue good luck to you.